Hey everyone, welcome to the Incubator Podcast. I'm your co-host Darren Boyd.
And this is Sabir Saran. Thank you for joining us today. Today we are here to talk about Endor Labs. And why Endor Labs? Because software ages like milk, not like wine. And to represent that, we are joined by Varun Badwar, who is the CEO and co-founder of Endor Labs, as a serial entrepreneur, formerly founder of Redlock, which was acquired by Palo Alto and part of the Prisma Cloud offering as we know it today. Varun, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Really excited to be here and chat about software aging like milk.
All right.
So if we may, Endor is in a very very specific area. Their dependency lifecycle management, addressing security and maintenance of open source. And that's incredibly important considering 80% of all code in modern apps, at least, is open source. And probably 95% plus of vulnerabilities are somewhere in transit of dependencies. And so having someone like Endor, who does so much in this space, and we're going to unpack it all, is exceptionally important. We're so glad to have you, Varun. If you could start maybe with your background and introduction of yourself, and then an introduction into why Endor, why'd you start it, what problems are you solving, the value prop, that would be a wonderful place.
Yeah, let's jump right into it. So I started out as a security practitioner. I was starting in consulting and advisory work at KPMG, you know, typical Fortune 500 clients, doing a lot of attestation advisory work around security, pen tests and the like. Ended up at Salesforce.com. Spent about 4 years there from the time there were 1,400 employees and five people in information security, seeing really the evolution of a cloud-first company and appreciating from there the concerns from an adoption perspective that mainstream enterprises would have, which was a turning point in my career because in 2010, 2011, I kind of pivoted towards starting my first company called CipherCloud, which really created what is now known as the CASB category, or when CASB was glamorous, the CASB category. And, you know, 5 years later, we kind of saw this other tidal shift around moving from data centers to cloud infrastructure and kind of seeing the writing on the wall with cloud architectures changing the security paradigms. Started Redlock, which 3 years later got acquired by Palo Alto Networks, where I then created and ran Prisma Cloud for about 3 years. Took it in my time from non-existent product at Palo to 300 million ARR. So it was a heck of a learning journey and evolution. But if you remember around that time, you know, 2020, late 2020, 2021, this thing called SolarWinds happened. And our board, like many other boards, asked us a lot of tough questions to assess and evaluate our supply chain posture. And in trying to answer those questions to the board and quantifying the risk, you really started to appreciate how software development had evolved from the time when I was running Redlock as a startup. I mean, more code now is code that you don't write, but borrow from complete strangers on the internet. I hate to even call it software supply chain security because these are not your suppliers. These are random strangers that give you no warranty, no SLAs, no contracts, based code. And for the most part, while we talk a lot about the open source by Databricks and Meta and others, the reality of the grassroots of open source is single maintainers, middle of any part of the world, working part-time on these parts of the code. And I think it's amazing because of how much innovation it fosters, but it's extremely dangerous if you don't understand what your developers are bringing in and what kind of evaluation and attestation you're doing. And just as we were starting to think about this problem, we were internally using a very popular software composition analysis tool to do the scanning. And you know, we had 68,000 alerts and most of them were turning out to be false positives as our developers would go review the code. And then you fight this exception battle between security and engineering teams. And the whole process was a nightmare. So I said, you know, looks like it's my calling to do company number three. And we started in the kind of open source software governance. And we said, there's got to be a better way than SCA to solving this problem. And that's kind of led us here. I don't want to get too far into what we do now. I'm sure we'll talk about that, but that's the background.
Yeah, that's absolutely huge. We've even seen some reports that say upwards of 159 developers for every one security practitioner. So putting out that kind of noise is exceptionally problematic, one for the developer, but two, the moment they turn and say, I'm sorry, can you show me that that is actually in the attack chain or that it's valid? You have a denial of service coming back. So we've always seen this disparity. And it seems like asymmetry is the word of the day here, because there is something very powerful about having open source projects. There's an asymmetric contribution to this innovation pool. And for the most part, that's a wonderful thing. But to your point, we have all sorts of problems that introduces. And I love the fact that you kind of called it out. It's these aren't your suppliers, but it is part of this supply chain that we've put together. So maybe Varun would be helpful. Maybe you can tee up a little bit of the challenge in this space. So maybe you could talk about why is it that it's so difficult to deal with addressing vulnerabilities with this kind of noise? Like, why is that happening today? Seems like a lot of people are in this space. There is some very focused companies in this space. What is happening that this is still such a big problem, and why does Endor exist?
Yeah, great question. So I think the fundamental shift starts with looking at how software composition analysis tools even began. Like 12 years ago, a lot of these tools started for license compliance. They were being bought by legal counsel, general counsels, because they wanted to uncover and unpack where am I using open source, because I need to understand the license and kind of further implications around intellectual property. And over time, that same technique of scanning evolved to vulnerability scanning, because people said, okay, for compliance, I need to now scan these same packages for vulnerabilities. And you said, well, my tool already produces a list of the open source packages I use. Now I can overlay that with vulnerabilities. It was fine when you had 5, 10, 15% of your code being open source, but all of a sudden, with both the increase in the number of vulnerabilities, but also the massive uptick in the use of open source, has made the same scanning approach just become untenable for the perspective of security. And so what I say is the existing tools in the market that many of your household names, I'm not going to name names, but these products are both incomplete and inaccurate. So let's unpack both of these terms. Why are they incomplete? Well, because there's more risk than just license and vulnerability risk today. It's a bit like a decade ago when you were doing endpoint security with signature-based AV products, and then kind of the world shifted towards EDR because you recognize that there are other threat vectors that your signature-based AV tools just will miss. And with open source, it's the same case. There's malware now proliferating, which are just malicious people putting malicious packages in the ecosystem. We find thousands of it every single month that we report and try to take down from these ecosystems. But thousands and tens of thousands of people are downloading them before we can. So how do we uncover these malicious intentioned open source packages? These are not CVEs. They don't show up as CVEs in your CVE scanning tools. So that's one. Software becoming dormant. Again, going back to software aging like milk, not wine. The fact that you're using something that's now 14 releases behind and you're vastly incompatible today than where this open source project has gone. Or even worse, there's a thriving project one day and the next day the maintainer says, you know what, screw all this. This is a thankless job. I'm just going to shut it down. Now you're using software that's completely unmaintained and unsupported. And similar to that, we have a whole report published. I encourage the listeners to take a look. It's called a Top 10 OSS Risk Report, which is where we believe there's lots of other risks that are super important to you today that your current tools don't catch. So that's the incomplete part. The inaccurate part goes back to the genesis of that these tools were built for licensing and vulnerability compliance scanning. So what they do is they all scan the same way. They scan what's called your manifest file of your application, and they'll see that, oh, I see you're importing these 1,000 packages. Great, guilty by association. I will assume that 100% of vulnerabilities apply to you. Whereas if you look at the research, what it's shown is your developers are using maybe 10 or 15% of those open source packages. So let's say you downloaded the AWS SDK. That SDK supports hundreds of services. You are using EC2. So only the code path that calls EC2 is the one which vulnerabilities apply to for your application. But your tools don't tell you that. So you say, developer, guilty by association, you have all these problems. And then they spend hours and hours and hours trying to code review and then come back to you and say, well, you're just wasting my time. And then you kind of get discredited and discredited further. So the fundamental signal that these tools miss is how, not what you're using, but how you're using these open source packages in the web of all of these dependencies that you apply. And we have taken a completely different approach to scanning this, which solves that problem, and that addresses the accuracy part of it.
So would that be the whole domain of dependency lifecycle management, Varun? if we may, or what would you describe how Endor solves both of the inaccuracy aspect of things and beyond?
Well, actually, something there's another problem, which is why we kind of eventually coined the term dependency lifecycle management, because we can keep fighting this battle of we'll scan your code pre-deployment and we'll tell you everything that's possibly wrong, but it's too late in the game. Like, your developers are married to these open source projects. They ain't going to take it out just because you're telling them to. Mm-hmm. And that kind of creates tension. We think, and the way we challenge ourselves is, what if instead of your developer having to go Google around to say, what should I use for logging, or what's a good web server written in Gorilla in Go? What if we could help them uncover what they need for their business, pre-analyze all of those recommendations for security, for operational risk, for health of the human risk, and other aspects, and give you a consolidated recommendation so you're not bouncing as a developer from Google to Stack Overflow to GitHub, doing your own evaluation of should you not use it, and then bringing it in. Instead, what if we could help you starting from that selection process? And what we've eventually ended up building in order to support this, because this is a large data set problem, there's 47 million open source packages and live versions out there. We've ended up building this massive infrastructure that's pre-scanning and pre-evaluating across hundreds of signals, all of these different open source packages, and basically presenting you, the organization, and the developers a Carfax report. A Carfax report for your open source that says, here are all the potential security issues, here are the code quality issues, here's the things you should know about this community, the people behind the community. Now it's your choice. And once we give you that choice, we expect developers will make better decisions. But as an organization, as a CISO, you can actually govern the process. So you can now write policies saying, I'm not even going to allow you to bring into my code base bringing in something that's got known vulnerabilities and has dormant for the last 6 months. And so you kind of, this idea of starting clean in order to stay clean really starts this conversation of lifecycle management. Because then you go from select to I have better things from the onset. I can secure them through a much more accurate mechanism that we just described. And I can help my developers maintain these libraries, not just tell them everything that's bad from a security perspective. How do you manage, maintain all of this open source software? How do you nurture it? And then eventually the last outcome becomes, okay, you want to produce an SBOM? Great, I have an SBOM, but guess what? I have confidence that what went into the SBOM, the ingredients before I post the wall of shame, I'm confident about, I can stand behind. Versus, I always tell people, there's 100 ways to produce an SBOM if you want it for free and cheap. But you're not going to be able to stand with a straight face in front of your clients or your customers who consume that SBOM because it's a wall of shame, right? It's airing all your dirty laundry. So select, secure, maintain, comply with all of these SBOM initiatives is what really dependency lifecycle management is all about.
Yeah, that's wow. That's huge for a lot of reasons. The we find ourselves often talking to customers about the idea of spend more time in the ideation side of things because it builds artisanship overall, right? We want all of our developers to have the option to make better choices. We want to make it simpler for them to make better choices as well. And I love that you're in that space. I think as some of the folks we've dealt with at Endor have said, we have this nutrition label as well that goes along with some of these packages, which is amazing. But you do things very, very well in the realm of dependency management. One of the things that, again, Sabir and I address a lot is even something as seemingly straightforward as semantic versioning. So Semver, we all know from a package maintenance perspective, can get really tenuous really quick. You have some folks that they're going to do version pinning because they want to control some of the supply chain. You have now, like, maybe some of these vulnerabilities are in a 0.0 release. That has a connotation. Yeah. Some may also have a difference in major releases. So now I've got a prioritization problem. We already have a timeliness of patches. So what does Endor do to help me operationally focus my time? So let's say, we've done the first half of this, which I think is arguably the most important, but now you help focus prioritization. Can you walk us through that story a little bit as well?
Yeah, so there's two parts. Like, how do you help the security team that's, mostly understaffed, overworked? And how do you help the developer? I think the piece we miss in this is the developers have a real pain with using open source because you keep stacking more and more open source over time. And the term that they use is dependency hell. So if you Google around, look on Twitter feeds for dependency hell, you'll just see the kind of wild stories. And we have this every week with our developers. It's at the forefront of our business. So I get to hear it from them every time it happens. But it's the silly thing. It's like, okay, I need to upgrade a package. I'm not quite sure. It's easy to say, just change it from version A to B. But when I change from A to B, who else's code in my company might I break? I don't know. I don't have any visibility into that. Or, I'm now 14 releases behind on an open source package. Nobody's knocking on my door and telling me. There's no customer success team that comes with open source saying, oh, we might recommend that you should do this by next week and let us help you. And, how do you actually kind of, open source takes nurturing. And it's not a set it and forget it mentality. And so for us, it's two things. And I'm a big believer in the next generation of successful security products will be those that not just make the experience easy for developers to consume, but go much further than that to actually help developers do their jobs better. And let's remember, their jobs are not vulnerability management. Their jobs are building and shipping code faster. And so the way Endcore Labs can help them is keeping a track of all of these different components and packages, who's bringing them, where are you using them, who else in your organization is using them, do you have enough test code coverage around the parts of the dependency that will be impacted if you change from version A to version B. It's all of these other things that make the developer pause for 6 months and fight you in security to upgrade a library. And we are trying to simplify that life and simplify that in the actual place where developers live, which is in the IDE. Like, we don't expect our developers to come into a UI and look at our alerts or go to Jira. The idea is give them this feedback early, give it to them in a preemptive, proactive manner, and really help them not just have strong security metrics and mean time to resolution, but good, strong operational help. I'll give you a very simple example. People always bring in open source software. Nobody's job in the company is thinking about what can I remove because I refactored my code and stopped using it. And so over the years, your applications get more and more bloated. Your build times keep increasing. With the way we evaluate your software, remember when I said we don't just say, what are you using, but how are you using it? That takes deep program analysis to uncover that. But a byproduct of that is I could tell if you've imported a library 5 years ago, but you're not using it anymore. And so we can make a recommendation to the developer to say, just remove it. Like, this is just carrying bloat. This is tech debt. Get rid of it. Your application will be lighter weight, less memory footprint, less CPU consumption, and less security vulnerabilities to chase around.
Yeah. This is amazing, Varun. Some of our clients are actually focused on very much so on the enriching the developer experience, right? And to your point, ship code faster and do what they do best or should be doing best, right? And then you have, of course, security's lens on things in terms of, oh, okay, I need to secure this. In your view, how does an AppSec program come together? So if you have the CISO or various kind of AppSec teams coming together to try to figure out to address this domain, you have your traditional SAST analysis and all these other things that they're like, everyone's trying to figure out, how do you cut the noise? There's the concept of correlation, ASOC, and all of that good stuff. Where do you ideally say SEA, OSS should be on the top priority of them, or where do you where do you think that we should fit this all into the equation, or how?
Funny. I was speaking to some analysts at Gartner, and I said, "What do you recommend to somebody who's starting an AppSec program from scratch?" And they literally said, "Look, 5 years ago, we would say start with SAST because majority of your code base is written by you. Your developers focus on that." They said today, we tell people start with open source because that's the majority of your code base. So A, the good news is it's not just vendors, it's an analyst who kind of recognize this and are helping customers from a very kind of a neutral perspective say the way to start building an AppSec program from scratch is focus on open source software first. Mm-hmm. Obviously, with the US government now calling this a national security issue, you're starting to see a lot more limelight on this problem, which is also great. In terms of how I have seen these programs either succeed or fail, and in fact, this is part of our evolution. Let me say this, actually, 60% of the time our product is purchased through security budgets. 40% of the time is actually purchased from engineering budgets. Why do I say that? It's important because it's not just a security product that's not painful for developers, it's actually adding value for developers. And that is super important in AppSec programs today because it's one thing saying, I'm going to force this tool down your throat for you to use. It's the other thing, getting the developers to draw and want to use this because it's helping them. But in order for these programs to succeed, you and the AppSec team have to partner with engineering platform team owners or the folks that have some responsibility of CI/CD. Because look, we can run Andor Labs as a product off to the side and give you alerts all the time. But if you want the fidelity of this information, it has to be ingrained in the development lifecycle. And one of the things when we go into POCs and evaluations with our customers, we actually say, if you want to deploy this and see it running in your environment, we actually require that you bring in an engineer that can build software from your side, because we're forcing the conversation to say you have to think about this not as an afterthought of security the way you have for decades with some of the traditional tools, because that's just how those tools are built. But to really solve this problem, get a partner with the security team and the AppSec team and the engineering platform teams and integrate the product in the right places. So that's really a big thing that I am very vocal about in our processes, but also conversations like this, is you can't do this as in a silo as an AppSec team.
Yeah, I love how you're tackling this too. I think if you look at all the packages in the Census 2 report, 50% of them didn't have a release in 2022, which is alarming. And so everything you've talked about is so critical to look at. So we're so thankful that you're doing it. I almost want to playfully ask the question, because we have some pretty big customers that say, look, at the end of the day, we'll just share critical and high CVSS, right? And look, the developer knows what they put in their software, so they can just exclude everything else. But at least if it's critical and high, that should be the only thing I really have to worry about. Is that not fair? So what do you say? And I say it's a little playful, but what do you say to the approach that still takes that kind of focus? And why is that not a great way to look at this?
Yeah, I'd say congratulations. That'll take you down from 2 million SCA alerts to 200,000, but 200,000 is probably 190,000 more than what you need right now. The other piece, look, I'm not going to get into the debate. There's very opinionated people that'll tell you why CVSS is dead or going to be dead or whatever else. Look, I think it's one indicator. It's an important indicator. It's one indicator. I think there's several other indicators. The other indicator is exploitability metrics. So there's EPSS now that tracks exploit predictability. We incorporate that into our product. We think you should have every possible signal outside in. But the most critical signal to operationalize this, automate this, and have credibility with your engineers is that signal that says, am I even using the part of the code that has the vulnerability? And then the next signal internally is, okay, well, how important is this asset? Is it internet facing? Is it actually in production? Or is this just test code? And so I think you've got to take it all together and then prioritize, and that's a big focus for us. And it's easier said than done, because the technology to understand that reachability of code is something that most vendors have shied away from. It's a hard problem to solve. You know, we have hired some of the best in the world coming from decades of research in this particular domain that have cracked the nut. And I say cracked the nut confidently because, you know, every quarter, like, we are replacing in deeply technical evaluations some of the best of breed current players in SCA just because of the dramatic reduction. So on average, we see a 76% reduction in vulnerabilities through this reachability analysis and building these call graphs. And that is substantial numbers because, you know, if I can shave off 100,000 vulnerabilities that your developers have to chase, I just gave your developers 800,000 man hours back to build software and write features. That's the math. So these are law of big numbers. And I think for this, you need to go far beyond CVSS.
Yeah, we couldn't agree more. And we just got back from RSA. Your booth was absolutely packed. And that kind of 80% reduction number was up there and getting a lot of attention. People know that this is a really hard thing to manage. And all of the aspects that you're doing, I think, dramatically changes the game. Just going back, I guess, like, one final question for me is, and keep in mind, if we didn't say it, like, you started in 2021, right? You've got a lot of attention from a lot of folks, and you're very, you know, new from a company perspective, a ton of experience in the space. When we're going to market, do you still recommend that people start with security programs in mind, or do you find the developer who's really the one suffering from a lot of this, do you find that's a valid place to start and get those conversations started? Because they're feeling, they're almost at the tail end of all the pain. Although the security practitioners are largely responsible for giving the visibility, the developer really feels that pain. Is that a logical place to start now these days with platforms such as yourself?
You know, I think AppSec and CISO's role is still very, very important. And I think that's still a really important part to evangelize these and kind of give them evidence and belief that all hope is not lost, right? Better technologies are coming their way. But I think with the emergence of these, what some people call engineering productivity organizations, in some places these are called engineering platform teams, I don't think the individual developer that's writing some code in a single repo cares, but the engineering platform and productivity teams, that's job is to look across engineering organizations, look across code repositories and say, how do I bring in more efficiency? Absolutely fair game. In fact, in a number of companies, we're getting sponsored by them, funded by them, and then being taken back to security to say, by the way, I'm going to check that box of yours through this. So I think it's both. The answer is not either or. It's both engineering platform teams and security teams. I think the reality is getting an individual developer to care about security things, as we have always recognized, is very hard. But I'm happy to see that these platform and productivity engineering teams are really focused on this.
Yeah. Varun, thank you so much for joining us today. We hope that our listeners really took away a comprehensive understanding of SEA, OSS, and more importantly, Endor Labs being a key linchpin in any AppSec program. And to your point just now, as well as earlier, it's a joint solution, meaning bringing the developers as well as the security teams together and embarking on this journey that reduces pain for everyone. So with that, thank you again, and looking forward to working with you guys.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. And if anybody listening here wanted to reach out and banter on some of the things I said, I'm pretty active on LinkedIn, so feel free to connect, and happy to kind of have a conversation.
That's wonderful. Thanks again.
All right.
Thank you.